Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. We regret to inform the audience that Amber McLaughlin has died from lethal injection at the death house by the Missouri Department of Corrections and the governor, Mike Parson. We understand that 3 reporters were removed from the prison grounds during the time of the execution of Amber McLaughlin. We would just like to say that Governor Parson sees investigative journalism as an enemy of his regime. With that, we'd like to mention the war correspondent Nate Thayer has died at his home in Massachusetts. Nate Thayer was known as the man who killed Pol Pot. He was the first journalist to hike 800 kilometers and interview Pol Pot, and his investigation led to the indictment of 15 other Khmer Rouge crimes against humanity of over 2 million Cambodians. We're going to pay tribute to Amber McLaughlin and Nate Thayer with this broadcast. Nate Thayer refused the Peabody Award. He sources reports to Ted Koppel of Nightline. Ted Koppel accepted the Peabody Award, and it's kind of a funny story. So we'll start out with that. We'll go to World's Forgotten Temples on YouTube, and he tells an interesting story about Pol Pot's last days. We're not going into the killing fields. This is just his bunker. There's rumor that Pol Pot lived until his old age, but that is not true. The Cambodians in the area said, no, Pol Pot was killed in his bunker. So like Pol Pot, Governor Parsons, Governor Brownback, they target people who they accuse of working against their perfect state. We'll start out with a little bit of David Bowie. We've got Blondie. We've got Golden Earring, Deep Purple, Iggy Pop. We thought we would put out some 70s jam on this podcast. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G.
Nightline anchor and managing editor and one of the finest American reporters of this and any other generation, Ted Koppel, is here to accept the Peabody. Congratulations, Ted.
Thank you.
Those of you who've read your liner notes will have seen the name of Nate Thayer in there. Nate is a frequent writer for the Far Eastern Economic Review, frequently works as an independent journalist, and he was the one who made it into the jungles of northern Cambodia to acquire the video, together with a cameraman, that you saw of Pol Pot. Nate has chosen not to accept this award because he has some profound differences with ABC News, with Nightline, with me. I'm sorry about that. Genuinely sorry. I disagree with the reasons for his disagreement, but that's for another time and another place. Nate has in many ways been living his own heart of darkness in Cambodia for more than a decade now. And while he rejects the award, I don't want to reject the enormous contribution that he made to bringing the world this story, not so much because I believe he should be obliged to accept accolades that he doesn't want, but because the importance of stories like this transcends simply a television program or a still picture or a magazine story. The importance of stories like this is that perhaps it will cause us to prevent the events for which Pol Pot was responsible from ever happening again. Although I must say, as I look now at Kosovo and the Congo and Nigeria and Indonesia, you have to wonder whether any television program is up to it. But I thank you nevertheless.
Congratulations, Ted.
Thank you. circus begin.
I can't escape from the scent of it.
The scent of my screaming skin.
ABC News and Nightline got a hold of some of the footage, right? And that became, of course, a part of your story. And an unfortunate part, of course, because of the controversy surrounding that. Maybe you can – what would be nice is if you can give us a little bit of context there, what happened. Of course, Ted Koppel got a hold of the footage, right? And then it mysteriously was dispersed to others throughout ABC. And from there, suddenly the story took its own turn. And a story that you had broke suddenly became ABC's story.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I was a freelance journalist. And I had three primary publications I wrote for. I had a number of encounters with Paul Pop. This was a top world story for a number of days. I had the first pictures and the first video of Pol Pot that had been seen in over 20 years. Yeah. But what was remarkable was that a freelancer, I owned all the rights to it. I hired my own video teams to come with me because I don't know how to, I'm not a cameraman. And I took the still pictures, but even that, I'm not a photographer, but I am a writer. So, but at the end of the day, I came out with it, and it was a zoo because I got over 5,000 telephone calls and messages.
Incredible.
Within a couple days before my story came out. I was offered ridiculous amounts of money from outfits that I didn't trust, including Murdoch. I turned down the highest bidders. My story was committed to the Far Eastern Economic Review, and I did that. They offered me more than my usual rates, and I turned it down because I knew that it wasn't just journalism, but it was a little snippet of history, and I had an obligation to do this properly.
Right.
So I wanted it published there because I knew they would do an excellent job, which they did. But it became, journalists are journalists. The word got out before the story was published that I had interviewed Pol Pot,
yeah,
and I had pictures and video. So I was contacted by pretty much everyone on the planet. Ted Koppel, who at the time Nightline did, really quality stuff.
Oh, yeah, I remember it well.
So he flew out to Bangkok. He wooed me, saying I was the second coming of Christ and so on and so forth. And back then, you made deals based on a handshake and a man's word of honor. Because in the news business, you've got to get the story out. So you don't have time for these lawyers to come in and do their thing. You take someone's word on it. So they had the rights to North American video rights only for Nightline. But once they got a copy of the tape and the transcripts that I'd made, this is all in Khmer, which is Cambodian language.
Yes, right.
They distributed, they took still frame grabs off of the video, still pictures, slapped ABC copyrights on them,
yep,
distributed them to, AP and every newspaper they could think of.
Yeah.
And they distributed the video worldwide, and they gave the transcripts to people. It was front page above the fold, New York Times, and every other news outlet in the world before I even got my own story out. And their strategy was simple. It was, okay, promise, this is what the lawyer, ABC's lawyers told Koppel. They said, look, promise the guy anything he wants. Just get a hold of the copy of the tape,
right,
and then we'll eat him alive.
Oh.
Because we'll bankrupt him, and we will, we'll make his life miserable if he objects. So that's pretty much what they did.
Right.
Ted Koppel is actually he was an excellent journalist, but at the end of the day, he was a pimp for his corporate masters. But that's how it works in the big business of media. I did object strenuously, to
yeah,
say the least. But the ABC corporate machine, they're so humongous that, they don't even know what the left hand or the right hand is doing. And they applied for major awards, with me as the ABC correspondent, and then won them.
Which is amazing, right? I mean, the prestigious Peabody Award, of course,
right,
and at which you were the first ever at the time to turn down the award, right?
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure the last ever, too.
Yeah.
And I don't think there was anyone who supported my decision to do it. But
yeah, I'm sure.
I'm very happy with my decision. Koppel called me up from New York after they'd refused to talk to me for 9 months or pay me their initial written agreement. And then I won the Peabody Award, and then he called me up saying, congratulations on winning the Peabody. I said, fuck you. Where's my money? I'm going to the Peabody Award, and I'm going to tell them what a fucking pimp ABC is. Now you guys are a thief and insult to the institution of journalism. So within like 24 hours, they sent money to my bank account.
Incredible.
But I showed up in New York at the Peabody Awards anyways, and they kicked me out.
Did they really?
but Koppel had to get up on stage because I knew they were going to kick me out.
Sure.
I know how these boys work. So I brought in my written statement of rejection of the award and tapped Ted Koppel on the shoulder from behind and He hadn't seen me since he showed up in Bangkok,
wow.
You know, promising me the world. And I swear his face turned white. I'm sure he thought I was going to punch him out, which, you know, that I don't punch people out except in writing. But I handed him the thing. So, you know, they basically thought I was insane and didn't. They knew that I was a loose cannon. So he had to get up on stage and acknowledge that I'd rejected the award.
I see.
In the meantime, I was escorted out by security guards. And I spent, while they were upstairs in the ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria, I was, this was like 11 o'clock in the morning in New York City. I was down in the bar, the only person at the bar, and it's like lamenting to the bartender how pissed off I was. He said, you know, I like a guy with principles. The drinks are on me. So I got double scotches all night.
Fantastic. Well deserved. And thank you for walking through that with me a bit. I appreciate that. You know, I can read so much and research so much, but to hear it from you is very helpful. And I can see, even in this, you know, conversation, I can tell that you are a principled man, and you wear your heart on your sleeve, in particular as a journalist and as a human being. And I don't know how often you hear this, Nate, but there's a lot of people that thank you for what you did and what you've done.
Well, I appreciate it. You know, I'm not very comfortable in general as a journalist. You're trained to keep yourself out of the story.
Right.
I'm more comfortable with just, hey, you know, I am what I am, I don't have I got plenty of warts, and just like everybody, and I think people relate to that because that's really all of us, right? So I find it, I've decided it's kind of uncomfortable to ask people about all their dirty laundry if I'm not willing to, you know, be transparent about my own.
where I'm standing right now with the sun going down in the west, if I was here in the 1990s, and even the late 1990s at that, I would have been killed. Because where I am, it's the very heartland of Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge. His house, his hiding place, is literally up in those hills where the sun is going down. Now, I've been battling long and hard to locate this place due to there being no internet connection. And as you can see, the day has run out. But tomorrow, I'm back on that road. This, I promise you, is a road less traveled. It has in fact taken me a day and a half to get here. There is no cell service, therefore my satellite imaging doesn't work. Of course, none of my maps work to guide me. The military stopped me at one border point and just would not let me through. I've been on many a road which has been a blind alley. But finally, I know this to be the road that takes me to Pol Pot's bunker, the last refuge of that tyrant and monster. Now, it's interesting, because through these trees is Thailand. I could literally walk into Thailand from here. Over here is Cambodia, and we're in proper jungle. He certainly knew how to hide himself, because finding this has been an incredible task. This is, in fact, his bunker. Over there was his house, and I'll be showing you around, and believe me, it's absolutely fascinating. But it's about time I told you a bit more about the Khmer Rouge. I mean, how did Pol Pot and his murderous gang actually seize control of an entire nation? Well, Pol Pot himself was educated in Paris. He didn't do exceptionally well, but whilst he was there, he hung out with the French communists. And when he returned, he brought back those ideas with him. Now, what amazes me is the ideas of communism he brought back were exceedingly simplistic. I mean, people like Stalin and so on had their ideas of communism, but they did blend them with a bit of, I don't know, a bit of business, a bit of commercialism. You've got to keep the money flowing, not Pol Pot. So when he did come back, he joined others that were like-minded, and they were pretty much in the jungle, ignored, until a pivotal point in history. And that was when the Americans started bombing the holy crap out of Cambodia. Because the Vietnamese they were at war with had ran trails for supply lines, and the Americans decided to disrupt those lines. And they bombed and bombed and bombed. They bombed so much, in fact, they dropped more ordnance than they did throughout the entire length of World War II. Now, I personally find this particularly odd, and I've never read this in a history book. Isn't it rather convenient for the Americans that had these enormous warehouses full of bombs that were taking a lot of money and space to store, all of a sudden they could just throw them out of planes and get rid of them? Because they were dropping dumb bombs, of course. And when Pol Pot and his Khmer Rouge came along saying everyone should be equal, look at the, you know, the death and destruction that's raining from the skies, why not join me? And we're going to change the government. And his ranks swelled, and they started to march towards the capital of Phnom Penh. And over time, the further they got, the more people fled. And they went to the capital. And the capital got bigger and bigger and bigger with the volume of people until that fateful day when Phnom Penh was taken over by the Khmer Rouge.
Back on here. 2 a.m. passenger all along. Can't get no connection, can't get through. Where are you? Well, the night was heavy on his guilty mind. This is far from the borderline. The hitman comes. You know damn well he has been cheated. And he said, help, I'm stepping into the twilight zone. Hey, the man of time.
Lorenzo, Kumbo, Irvin, welcome to Tell a Friend. I was saying I invited you onto my show to talk about the re-release of your book, Anarchism and the Black Revolution, which has now been re-released by Pluto Press. Now, for those who don't know, this book was actually originally released in 1979 as a pamphlet, which later turned into a book. And I wanted to firstly ask you, you know, how does it feel that your book, after all of these years, still resonates with audiences and is still being used to teach, you know, new generations of radical and new generations of anarchists?
Well, I'm humbled by knowing that the book has longevity and that it is an important, you know, to many people, it's an important book. But I don't get, you know, overly confident or overly excited over that fact. I use that as a means of explaining to myself that I need to do more. In fact, I need to write more. You know, I that book is 42 years old. At least it started. It started as a pamphlet 42 years ago, as you had pointed out. But the reason it is still around with relevance is because I was trying to think in advance rather than think, you know, in the time frame I was in. I mean, the time frame I was in was important, but I wanted to think about something in the future, how what we say and do in this period influences the future. That's what I wanted to be able to do. And so from that standpoint, I'm very proud of the book, but I'm not, you know, crazy egomaniac over it. I mean, I think it's an extremely important book, but it's more important to others than it is even to me.
You know, obviously, you know, when you say anarchism to people, you know, let's be real, people have all kinds of preconceptions or, you know, misrepresentations about what it stands for. You know, they think of violence, they think of chaos, you know, we all know this. But what I really like is, you know, right from the beginning of the book, you write, let's look at the real world and see who's causing all of the violence. And then you go on to list, you know, the world wars, talk about Vietnam and, you know, what is done by the state. And then you put here, if we speak honestly, we must admit everyone believes in violence and practices it, however much they may condemn it in others. Either they do it themselves or they have the police or army to do it on their behalf. And I really wanted to pick on that point and ask you, to what extent have these myths around anarchism prevailed? Or do you believe that, you know, you've been closer to actually getting people to wake up and understand what anarchism actually means?
Well, you understand that over a long period of time, the governments of the world have utilized small-scale attacks by anarchists, individual assassinations of a president or of a leader of industry, so-called captain of industry. And they've seen those attacks with what was called propaganda by the deed. And they've denounced anarchism in such a way to denounce everybody, every person who's an adherent of the movement, saying that they just believe in mindless violence. And it isn't just the capitalists that have done that or the rich. It is, in fact, even ideological rivals like in Marxists and others have, you know, Leninists in particular, have said the same thing and used that as a justification for stifling the entire movement in Russia and other countries, Spain and other countries. They've used that to claim, oh, well, the anarchists are just, automatically violent. Well, the reality is a very small portion of the anarchist movement at any historical moment has ever even engaged in violence. The great majority have not engaged in violence. They've engaged in massive protests of one sort or another, you know, mass movements, but they haven't engaged in so-called violence, which the state, especially the American government, has used it for years to try to claim that anarchism by itself, just an ideology of chaos and of violence. And there's no proof for that whatsoever. In fact, the attempts that anarchists have made to organize in countries that were having revolutions or were having mass protests. It was the state that crushed them, or the so-called left, you know, rivals of anarchists. But the main thing is that, yes, it has been the state which is the greatest purveyor of violence, bar none. I mean, we can say the world wars, but even before the world wars, it's been incessant wars ever since the creation of the state and of violence. There has been, they've been the main ones waging war. Millions and millions of people have been killed as a result of the various wars that have taken place, whether the colonial wars, where they took over countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, or the world wars or nation-state wars of any sort, of which there are numerous ones. You know, the reasoning for their engaging in violence is acceptable to some people inside of the country they're in because of fake patriotism that even to this day, the idea that they could invade another country, whether it's Iran or Iraq or wherever, and a considerable segment of the population would support it. Well, the anarchists, one of the first groups that came out against World War I, and of course many of them were put in prison, the anarchists and libertarian socialists were put in prison as a result of just coming out and speaking against the war, speaking that it was a rich man's war. Poor people and working people had no stake in it because they came out with the so-called Espionage Act around that time. In fact, it's being used to this very day. In fact, that's what they're trying to use to put people in prison right now.
And that was Lorenzo Comboa Irving with Tell a Friend from UK, the fourth edition of his book, Anarchism and the Black Revolution. We will continue with Golden Earring, starting out with Candy's Gone Mad, continue with the Khmer Rouge raid on Phnom Penh, the capital city of Cambodia. We'll talk about agricultural programs, talk about the corruption, and then we'll take a listen to a description of Pol Pot's bunker, what it was like during his last days. Then we've got prison poetry from Michael Lenore, Washington State Penitentiary. This is the Abolition Hour. I'm Carl G.
Is anybody feeling tearish tonight?
It's gonna be hot out there.
take them long before they started killing people. I mean, this is what makes Pol Pot so incredible. They march into the capital, and through speakers and loud hailers, they announce the Americans are coming. They are going to bomb the capital. Everyone has to get out. It's for your own good. You have 3 hours. And what they did in that single instant was turned every single person into a peasant, in effect, because they weren't allowed to take anything. You're just leaving for a short while. Now, of course, some people did protest. They were taken round a corner and shot, as well as leading scholars. They were taken away and tortured. The killing began the moment they turned up, and it didn't end.
Don't fucking believe the hype is the fucking message of this song.
Yeah. just on. Inside, and I just saw this life. So do you feel it? Say, do you feel it when you cut me? Or do you feel it when you cut? That it's a fire, that it's a fire. 'Cause I'm just a burning, and I'm just a dreamer, and I'm just a
But the whole thing is completely flawed because you're sending people into the field who have absolutely no experience at all with agriculture. And not only that, the higher-ups decree that, let's say, 1 acre of rice field should now produce 5 times its normal yield. These numbers are impossible. So what happened? The managers of those fields, shall we call them, start to lie. But these lies then become transparent in their failing because the rice never turns up. Then the blame game begins. The only reason the rice hasn't turned up or the yields haven't been produced is because people are working against our perfect state. So here's an example. I am ploughing a field with a basic trowel that breaks. Obviously, in their twisted world, I broke the trowel deliberately because I'm against the Khmer Rouge themselves. And if I'm against the Khmer Rouge and I'm a subversive, I'm in it with other people. I get carted off to a camp and someone pulls out my nails with pliers. They stub out lit cigarettes in my eyeballs. Because they know I'm a subversive and I've got to name names. And I do name names through the agony of it all. And I name anyone I can think of, my neighbors, school teachers, I mean anyone. Of course my family are already guilty. And they say let's get 20 names. So they go off and get those 20 people and the process repeats. They start killing them off as well whilst collecting more names. What they effectively did was create a carousel of death.
Go!
Baby, baby.
how did it all end? Well, because the Khmer Rouge was so out of touch, nobody could ever issue bad news, and this is why all dictators fail. They thought they were much stronger than they actually were. So they started a war with Vietnam. Well, I say war, but because it wasn't. The Vietnamese literally just walked across the border with their tanks and everything else, and the Khmer Rouge literally evaporated. They had no fighting strength at all. I mean, all this stuff that was in their heads was in Never Never Land. So they retreated back. And with the help of various governments, not so much the West, I must say, they were finally penned in. But they were still had an influence until 1999. I mean, it's quite incredible. In the late 90s, the Khmer Rouge still had a voice of sorts. And it was only in the 90s that some of these people were brought to trial. It is a fascinating story, and you really should look some more into it. Because when it comes to insane leaders, dictators, you've got to go an awful long way to beat Pol Pot.
Look out!
Pol Pot's compound. Over there is the house I'll show you in a moment. Here is the bunker. To the right off screen is his garage. Now, why was he here? Well, have a look at this. That is Cambodia. And from up here, I can see absolutely anybody coming. And if you're a paranoid nutter, this is the view you want. And the other thing you can do is run a mast up here and communicate very clearly with your troops. But his main reason for being up here was his back door. We are literally on the very edge of the border with Thailand. Anyone comes this way, I'm legging it. Now, I've been very fortunate because I had trouble getting through to here. It originally wasn't understood by the military as to my reasons. But it was made. But through this door would have been a house.
And we're very fortunate because we can make an awful lot of details here. And with the help of the military man who's guided me in, he has helped me understand it oh so much better. For here would have been the front door. And as we go in, what we see here is one bedroom. And here, a second bedroom. It could also be a radio room, something of that sort, because there's not a lot of space. One would have doubled up what rooms were used for. I mean, he was hung by his own petard. He couldn't have anything grand because his whole ideas was we just work together and share everything. No one can be different.
Yeah. No fun. so fun.
Woo!
I know good, my babe, and no fun. No fun to be alone. Walking by myself, there's no fun to be alone. And alone with nobody else. Well, maybe go out, maybe stay home, maybe call mom on the telephone. Well, come on, 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 well, come on. No fun to be alone. No fun. So be alone, hi back there. Hang on, don't you let me go. And no fun, so be alone. I said I'll be alone. Said I'll be alone. It's so fun. What I say, come on now there in the back. You in the back, tell me how you feel. You over here, how do you feel? You over here, I know how you feel. Yeah. All right, Ron. Come on, Ron Aston. Let me hear you tell him. Let me hear you tell him. Tell him how.
Woo! Woo! Woo!
On your phone!
Woo! Woo!
Lift up my baby!
Yeah! 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 Welcome on, baby! Welcome on! Well, come on, baby. Yeah. No fun. No fun. No fun. No fun. All right.
Iggy and the fucking Stooges. Iggy and the fucking Stooges! Iggy and the fucking Stooges! Stooges!
Woo! Woo! Alright! 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 Well, alright! Alright! Good fucking evening! And here I stand with Cambodia in the background. The madman's lair, just there. The one story that really personifies this whole thing for me is when the liberating army entered Phnom Penh, and what they saw absolutely shocked them. The capital was 100% empty. The only living things there were a few stray dogs. Now, if that was not bizarre enough, the whole capital had the stench of death because there was rotten corpses. But around their feet, blowing in the wind, was money because Pol Pot had made it year zero. There was no need for money. There's no need for individualism. You don't need to own anything. You just work the fields. It was the craziest system that has ever been seen on this planet. And being here is just fascinating. I will never forget this day.
Blow on it right now! Woo! I feel alright! I feel alright! But oh, Seb! Woo! Let's go! Here we go, motherfucker! We'll be right back.
a call in from a fun house with my song. We've been separated, baby, far too long. Call in all you whoopsies, pretty pink, shining in your freedom. Come and be my ring. Hold me tight. Call in from the fun house. Hold me tight. Call in from the fun house. Go! Now keep on it, cause it's a mother. It's a mother, baby. Good God.
A little baby girl, a little baby boy. Cover me with love and a bundle of joy. Do I dare to show you what I'm dreaming of? Do I dare to whip you with my love? Every little baby knows just what I mean. Living in their vision in a shifting scene. Hold me tight. Calling from the fine house. Hold me tight. Fun house. Oh!
I am you.
Washington State Prison. I'm currently incarcerated at Washington Correctional Center, a true activist out here in the Great Northwest. I want to introduce this piece called A Strong Mind. And the reason why this piece is so important is because when you're incarcerated, it's everything designed within the system that encourages us to be everything but strong. And the way to stand up in the midst of this oppression, you have to make sure that it starts first mentally, and then it works outside to your physical. And so here it is, a strong mind. Prison has made me strong, not weak. Striving in conditions where fathers let them take responsibility for what they did. My pain is my motivation, and it drives me to a satisfactory type of success. When I lay down at night, I wonder who thinks about me while I'm here. Another year went by with most of my time spent in submission, but I realized that I'm the cause of my own agony. Who can I blame when I know the difference between right and wrong? Even though I've been excluded more time than I've been included, I push on with a mic that's immeasurable. All I ask is that one just believe in me. And even if then all else, I have to believe in myself. No one can be there for me wholeheartedly but me. I am the father of my many sub-personalities. In this environment, you could be surrounded by 200 men at any given time and still feel lonely. Physically, we are here together, but consciously, we are the distance between Earth and Mars. Every day, I rise to conditions that are unacceptable. Uneducated men, absent fathers who don't care about being away from their children, men who lack vision, souls that are spiritually bankrupt, and brothers who have been away from society so long they don't even know that they're hurting. These are the realities of the feeble mind. These are the classification of men who indulge in self-effacing mannerisms daily. Unaware of the long-term effects of these choices, they plunge deeper into those harmful behaviors. We cannot find ourselves until we lose ourselves, but how many are ready to face the unknown? It is evident that the courage is missing. We cannot find ourselves until we lose ourselves, but how many are ready to face the unknown? It is evident that the courage is missing. Our bodies wander aimlessly because our minds are filled with things that hold no significance. American imperialists have been diluting the black man's focus with fashion, drug use, and high hopes of making it big in show business for their entertainment. It is no different than taking two of the biggest slaves and fighting them against each other for the purpose of amusement. Our minds are so weak we convince ourselves that we own the street corner, that when the police come, we run. I said our minds are so weak we convince ourselves that we own the street corner, that when the police come, we run. An extension of this truth can be seen even on the prison yards. Men from all races rush with diligence to claim pieces of the Department of Corrections property, tables, exercise bars, and even showers. They have us right where they want us, striving for a false sense of power. But wake up. Incarcerated men and women, wake up. In the eyes of justice, I am looked upon as a man who deserves no attention from society. However, if you look upon my melanin attached to my physical structure, you see the masculinity of a focused, headstrong, black man. Racism can never identify the prosperous qualities of a black man. I'm defined by my constant efforts to achieve on a higher level. My morals, principles, and values are filled with a healing type substance. I never had to figure out who I was going to be. All I had to do was determine who I was going to be. Prison can't define me, I define it. From the outside glancing in, you probably vision me locked inside of a steel cage. Push that vision to the side and make room for what really is. I am a man that has turned his pain to power. Education is my road to success, along with assisting brothers on their journey for healing and guiding them back to the path of progress. My goals as an ambassador of peace are to elevate the minds of the incarcerated so they develop the ability to free themselves mentally. Yes, there are really men that push this type of agenda in prison. I am just one of many. For the black men and women, we know the Caucasian man and women have been creating mental designs to control our minds since the beginning of America's time. If you recognize this, what else can you see? I see opportunity to lead brothers and sisters in the community in the vision to create new designs that will allow all people to prosper tremendously as destined by the Most High. When I first entered the system, I had the negative attitude of many black men and women who fall victim to this prison system. I joked, I fought, used drugs and uplifted my street game. This is all I cared about. I was dead weight occupying a bed in a space until a brother pulled me to the side and asked me a question that became an inflection point in my time of doing time. He said, do you know the best way to keep a secret hidden from a black man? I said, no. He replied, all they have to do is put it in the book because we don't read. In this moment, I felt shamed, humiliated, and disappointed. I thought to myself, how does a man doing 26 years end up in a cycle of fictitious thinking? Convicted in my spirit, I made my way to the prison library, and it is here where the expansion of my mind began. Where will the story of your strong mind begin? My incarcerated brothers and sisters, I encourage you by all means necessary. In order to eradicate this system, we have to educate ourselves. We have to read. There shouldn't be a time or a moment that a book is not in our hands, and that we're not taking the time to organize the individuals around us and calling them to something much higher than what consists of the programs in the prison system. Thank you for listening. Michael Lanier, you can go to jpay.com, download the app, punch in Michael Lanier, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, last name L-I-N-E-A-R. My badge number is 847-176. You select the Department of Corrections. I'm located in Washington Correctional Center in Washington State, and my facility is Shelton, Washington. Or you have the ability to write me at Washington Correctional Center, P.O. Box 900, Shelton, Washington, 98584.
And this concludes our podcast for January 7th, 2023. We dedicated this podcast to the late Amber McLaughlin, executed by lethal injection by the governor of Missouri, and to Nate Thayer, war correspondent, Cambodia. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G.